Tereo Ererangi o Te Mania. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
Coming up next, conversations on human rights with Speak Up, Kōrero Tia, here on Plains FM.
E nā mana, e nā reo, e nā hō e whā. Tēnā koutou katoa, no mai ki tēne hōtaka. Speak Up, Kōrero Tia. Tune in as our guests speak up, sharing their unique and powerful experiences and opinions. And may you also be inspired to speak up when the moment's right.
Ko Speak Up ko rero te tene, ko sale kātana ho. Today we are thinking about Pākehā engagement with te ao Māori, and more specifically, whiteness. What does it mean, and specifically what does it mean in the context of Aotearoa, New Zealand? We have two guests with us, Elizabeth Ann Cook, Lizzie, who's just written a book about this, and Ella Henry from the University of Auckland. I'm really looking forward to hearing from both of you about your perspectives on this very big, very gnarly concept and the journeys that have taken you to where you are today. Lizzie, how about we hear from you and particularly about your book as we get started?
I did a master's in Pākehā spirituality, and I was very surprised from my research, my interviews. I did 41 interviews with people aged between 20 and 90. I was very surprised at the lack of engagement with te ao Māori, and I had gone into the master's with an assumption that Pākehā would be thinking more about their relationship with the land and maybe their relationship with te ao Māori. And, of course, that's connected to the land. And I was really surprised that it wasn't there. I didn't have specific questions. I had a list of questions which were specific to people themselves personally. But I would drop in things about te ao Māori and I would get these strange looks. So I came out of that master's really surprised that my assumption that Pākehā would be more connected to whenua and to more interested in te ao Māori was wrong, and that was my own thing that I had. So I decided to do a PhD on why do so few Pākehā engage with te ao Māori, and why are they so against Māori sovereignty? And the research from my master's was that most people live where they live because of family. So it's not a particular connection to the land. I have a very strong connection to Te Tai Tokirau because I was born and bred in Whangarei, and that's kind of a real sense of belonging that I have. But I also wanted to live between the mountains and the sea, so I came to Christchurch, and I've lived in Christchurch most of my life now. The whenua has always been a really strong thing in my life. So I did my research for my PhD, took 5 years, and then I decided to make it into a book because with what was happening, I was particularly, concerned with politics, what was happening in politics. I mean, the current coalition government demonstrates everything that I talk about in my book about whiteness and so I think it's a very topical book for people to get their heads around in terms of how do they respond to racist comments that they hear around them. The last third of my book is actually references and footnotes. So there's plenty of extra reading and support evidence for what I'm saying in the book. So my book is really for people. It's sort of to give them knowledge and ideas of how to respond, because it's very hard when you listen to the news sometimes. How do I respond to what's been said? I know that this is wrong, but I'm not quite sure what the facts are. So, for example, when you hear people going on about Māori, you know, they're criminals, Māori are 11 times more likely to be imprisoned for the same crime as a Pākehā. So when you have evidence like that, it shows that there is something happening in the system that is not because Māori are worse than a Pākehā. No, they're being imprisoned for the same crime, but the Pākehā got off, but the Māori person didn't. So that's basically how my book rolls. Yeah.
Great, thank you. And for anyone listening, it's called Unsettled Bliss, Whiteness in Aotearoa. And Ella, it would be great to hear a wee bit about you. Ko wai koe, what's your journey into what we're talking about today?
I te tīmata, me mihi atu ki a kōrua, ki a koutou katoa, ko Ngāti Kahu ki Whangaroa Te Rārawa, me Ngāti Kuri o ku iwi ko Ella Henry tōku ingoa. So that's the way I always start a hello. Mm. Those who know the Māori world will know we have very long hellos, but our goodbyes are even longer. I'm a professor of entrepreneurship in the business school at the University of Auckland, a proud wahine Māori from Muri Whenua, a little bit further north of Whangarei than you, Lizzie. And in fact, when I do my pepeha, I often tell people that in 1,000 years, not one of my ancestors went south of Mangamuka for a missus. So it's a miracle I haven't got three eyes, quite frankly. And so the origins of whiteness and the origins of what I will call Pākehātanga, for lack of a better word, which is the culture surrounding the white settler population in this country, has formed a basis of much of my research over the last 40 years. Primarily because my research is focused on me, as all good research is, and certainly your book, Lizzie, is, I think, a reflection of that. I wanted to understand how I had come to be in this world and what ingredients had created the space that I existed in. And I'm telling you, as somebody who was born in 1954, 70 years ago in Kaitaia, when as a child we would walk down Commerce Street, and when white people came towards us, my mother and father would get out of the way. Because by the 1950s, they had internalized our position of inferiority. My parents' generation, born at the very beginning of the 20th century, who went through some of the worst impacts. They'd lost our land. We lived in desperate poverty. They worked in the gum fields. My father went to war, blah, 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 blah. And they were the last generation of Māori who genuinely believed that we were inferior, because that had been pounded into us for over 100 years. And keep in mind that the notion of whiteness is very new, even in European culture. It's a post-Enlightenment phenomenon that was invented at about the same time as imperialism and colonization. Because if you were going to send peasants out into the world to conquer savages, which is basically what colonization meant, particularly in India, then you had to convince the peasants that they had something going for them. Otherwise, they might align themselves with the people they were meant to oppress, which is what happened here when the Irish came here and saw what the government were doing to us. There's a whole, platoon of Irish that revolted, and some of them ended up north, and one of them ended up in my gene pool. And because they hadn't inherited necessarily that same sense of whiteness meaning superiority, but it was a very useful tool for those who controlled the means of production to ensure that the foot soldiers of colonization would remain true to whatever the ideology was. And I was in a taxi only last year when my Hindu taxi driver said, you know, the British invented the caste system. And I went, what? And immediately disappeared down this dark hole to find out it was true, that the caste system, the Hindu system, was a British invention. And there's all this fascinating stuff about how it was used to perpetuate a particular view about India at the time when they wanted to maintain control, because they had, absolute power over information, and India was a diverse society. So the best way to control these diverse populations was to make them believe in a system that they maintained. The same thing happened with colonization here when settlers came from many places in Europe where they could never own land. They could never be landowners in Britain because of, the commons. And we still have that system here whereby if, you go out there and you can own land and you can be a warrior and you can be your own person, the only thing standing in their way was us. So the easiest way to get access to land was just to get rid of us. Unfortunately, we're nuggety little suckers and it didn't work. Mm-hmm. And so here we are, 184.5 years later, trying to figure out how to make it work. And I'm not trying to purport this notion because I have anything particularly against whiteness per se or white people. I am very fortunate to live in a world where tangata tiriti are wonderful allies, have married in, and we've created, you know, extraordinary families and kāinga and communities. But there is a hardcore community in this country that unfortunately are bubbling up because of the current political environment, who cannot and will not be able to understand how collaboration is better than competition, and how working together is better for our country than hating each other. And I just want to end on a last point, really, because it's a delicious irony that the people who came to this country who could never have owned land and who could never have been aristocracy in a country that defined you not by the color of your skin, but by your accent, invented and created a society where the two most played sports were those of the gentry. Rugby and cricket, the two sports of the wealthy and powerful in Britain, were what they brought here, along with their roses and their possums and their rabbits. And I think it must be profoundly irritating 150 years later to find out that Māori and Pacific Islanders play those two games quite well, actually. But that's an aside. Anyway, sorry, I babbled on a bit.
No, it was very entertaining. It was...
It was a great introduction. So we've already sort of touched on it, but I think to kick us off in this kōrero today, what is whiteness? It's this huge concept, and you've already sort of delved into it, but it would be great to think about for our listeners, what exactly is it?
The best person to read about is Charles Mills. He's a Jamaican-American philosopher, and the other person is Achilles Bebe, spelled M-B-E-M-B-E. They have talked, well, Charles Mills basically says whiteness is white supremacy. It's a structure the same as capitalism. So capitalism is a structure. We live in it. We perform it, whether we agree with it or not, whether we agree with the form that, because there's many different kinds of capitalism that you could have. There's many different kinds of economic structures that you can have. And people tend to get into these binary arguments, you know, like capitalism, oh, you must be a communist. But no, there are many different structures. And we are in a structure that privileges the wealthy. We're in a structure of white supremacy. And New Zealand was founded on that structure. White supremacy is a structure. And so whiteness is an ideology. I call it a white ideology. It's a particular view of the world. What we get used to is looking through a white lens, and we forget that there are other lenses to look through. There are other ways to look at the world. And one of the problems with white ideology is that we often claim it as normal, natural, and universal. So if you are not like me, you are not right. I am the universal thing. And this is ironical because white people are only 16% of the world's population. And so when you think of the power position of white ideology in the world, actually we're only 16% of the world's population. And we've got this dominant structure that we say is universal. There's other ways of looking at the world. There's all these other cultures and their ways of looking at the world. And in our own country, we are a particular white ideology. We are the settler population. So the settler population, we are very similar to Canada and Australia, and we are in someone else's country. And I think that's what so many people forget. They forget that we have arrived somewhere and we've caused incredible mayhem. You always hear these things, oh, we brought education to this country. We brought this to this. They forget, well, education was already here, actually. It just was a different form to the form that we use, and so on and so forth. So whiteness is an ideology. It's a way of looking at the world, and it's a way of saying, if you're not like me, you're not okay. And we participated in it. And the thing in my book is that it's a really banal, everyday thing that is done. We participate in it in a banal kind of way. The system is around us. We participate in the system that's around us. And we need to look at the banalities of what we do every day and question them, challenge them, self-reflect.
Would you like me to chime in?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm very much of the view that, and I agree with everything you said, Lizzie, but certainly a number of scholars on race in particular have agreed that the modern meaning of whiteness pretty much comes out of centuries of European colonization and imperialism, much of which followed the Renaissance, and that Renaissance period was crucial in the early development of capitalism. So I think of capitalism as a progression from feudalism, I suppose, but still maintaining the same power relationships between those who own everything and those who don't. You know, whether you are a peasant or a proletariat, it's just a word. The power still rests with a particular class of people, I suppose. But what's interesting about capitalism is it expands access to that power, where once it had to be through the church or aristocracy, suddenly the new industrialists after the Renaissance were able to gain enough wealth and privilege that they could then join, you know, the ruling classes. And so that kind of dynamic is part of what gets exported to Aotearoa in you know, from the 18th century, but certainly from 1840. And I think, you know, we forget that it wasn't just imperialism that colonized New Zealand, which obviously has an assumption of white supremacy, but also capitalism, which is based on a notion of individual wealth and privilege, and that's reinforced by Christianity, which is a very monotheistic ideology, and ultimately, for me as a Māori woman, the worst, which is patriarchy, with the assumption of male supremacy. So we got, you know, Māori got this whole grab bag of new ideologies that were fine when they were out there and we were trading with Britain and had a good, healthy, you know, because when you consider between Cook arriving in 1769 and the treaty in 1840, we had basically 70 years of relatively good relations with Britain. I mean, the Whakaputanga of 1835 was about reinforcing that relationship, and Britain, you know, accepted our flag in 1836 and gave us the protection of the Navy for our ships when they were plying our trade across. So there was no reason why we'd assume that that relationship with Trey wouldn't carry on once we signed the treaty. Unfortunately, obviously, history tells us that didn't happen. And as an aside, you know, the day we signed the treaty, Māori women became had all the privileges of British subjects at a time when women in Britain were chattels. They were literally owned by their fathers, which is why they had their father's name, until he gave them away in marriage to somebody whose name they then took up. So, you know, when you think of that whole parcel of difference that first was interesting because it was out there but then was imposed on us, it's meant that the impact on Māori has been absolutely devastating. So now we have, you know, seven generations of intergenerational poverty and you know, the self-fulfilling prophecy theory that if you kick a man enough, don't be surprised when one day he bites you, is the underlying logic to what is happening with so many of our broken communities, with crime and all of the manifestations of battered wife syndrome, self-hatred, suicide, crime, drug dependency. These are all effects of the dislocation of our community. So what I am most impressed about your work, Lizzie, is how do we fix it as a society? And my view is, only white people can fix whiteness. Only Māori people can really fix Māori brokenness with the support of the government agencies. So how do we work collaboratively to create the infrastructure that enables some change to occur? And I thought, because I went on the Hīkoi last year, that what was so extraordinary about it was when I was in Wellington in front of Parliament, I looked out over the crowd and at least half of those people in that crowd were not Māori. And that was us speaking to power together. So when we are capable of speaking to power together, I think the change is transformational. And so the notion that there are not three countries or three nations, but three peoples in this country, tangata whenua, who were here before the treaty, tangata tiriti, who are here because of the treaty, and tangata moana, whom we have a different relationship with because we are all part of the diaspora of the South Pacific. But those three peoples all have different histories, all bring different ingredients to the soup mix that is Aotearoa New Zealand. And when we figure out how to finish off making that soup and how to all enjoy it, I think we're going to have one of the most extraordinary countries to live in. You know, people look at my daughter. I have three daughters, and they're not brown coloured particularly because they're of multiple ethnicities. But as I say to people, I call my daughters caramellos. They are that delicious mix of dark chocolate and white sugar. They are 100% Māori, 100% Dalmatian, 100% Irish, 100% Scottish. And who gets to define which percentage that is but them?
A lot of the things that you've said I cover in my book. One of the things that I'm particularly, I reject is the word race. But we have to talk about race because we have to talk, it's part of the way people think, but there actually is no such thing as race from my perspective. It is an invented concept that comes out of eugenics, a pseudo-scientific idea of differences in humanity. So my book specifically, yeah, I refer to different culture, different ethnicities, but people even use the word ethnicity like they use race. But race, we are actually one humanity. But we are different cultures, and those cultures are very important and very distinctive, and they require negotiation in terms of how we interact with different cultures. The word race, it gets into that idea of blood quotient, and I really like the way you said 100% Irish, 100% Scottish, 100% Dalmatian, 100% Māori, because actually there is no such thing as blood quotient. It's ridiculous. It's the same blood. I know that there are people who will argue with me, but really my most important thing is that we are one humanity, and there is biological evidence that the visual differences are simply because for eons of time, we were separated geographically. So we are shared DNA, except down the track, there are susceptibilities to certain diseases within certain cultural groups. You know, that brings up that word that's banned at the moment, which is equity. So that requires, you know, different strategies around equity and health, that sort of thing. But yeah, basically that's a little point that I wanted to just say there about my response to the word race. Yeah, but lovely kōrero. Yeah, Ella, it's really lovely. Listen, you're so colourful. The way you story tell. I definitely agree that white people are responsible for their own liberation, and in the same way with women, that women, we are responsible for our liberation, but men need to be our allies. Annie Makairo and Moana Jackson are two really important intellectual contributors to my thinking in my book, and that multiple impact on Māori women is something that I acknowledge in my book of the colonial machine. Yeah, that when white people came to New Zealand, women were the chattels of their husband. And I refer to how that violence, that colonial violence is still within our society, and it has affected Māori men. And that denigration of the importance of the female and the mother and the tangata whenua within cultural thinking. So that's something that I engage with in this book.
Maybe I can throw some thinking in here, because I know dealing with very specific issues like why naming whiteness is important, and I think that is something that you've addressed really well, Lizzie, and I appreciate that. I guess really, for me, the critical issue is what are we doing moving forward? And I'm reminded of what an interesting time we are in, because as I said, there is around the world a rising very neoliberal, very conservative, very white right wing, and very oppressive regime that's moving through a number of countries who, as you said, are starting to realize that in fact whiteness is slowly disappearing. It's becoming more caramelized by the world.
But also we just need to accept that we're an identifiable group amongst many other, because in my book I also push for ethnic identity and within white people. My ethnic identity is my English, Irish, Welsh background, mainly English, English dominated.
Sorry, that's a metaphor.
Yeah. But you know, my partner is Dutch. He's white, but he's Dutch. So I actually think one of the pathways for change is for us to think of ourselves as ethnic entities in amongst other ethnic entities. So my whiteness, actually being Pākehā, the word Pākehā for me is a word that means white person, and it has validation for anyone who's European, whatever they call themselves. It only has validation because they have power over other people. We have power over other people. You take away that power and we are just another group. So what is your background? When I have taught beginner te reo Māori to Pākehā, I constantly ask them, look for your background. What is your whakapapa? Where do you come from? Because that is what you still carry. I carry my Englishness. I mean, while I eat lots of different cuisine, my go-to food is, you know, my comfort food is very English in its design. And my Irish Catholic background has inspired me in lots of ways as well. But it gives you an understanding of being part of a whole patterning of people. And I love that. I really love that I can talk about my whakapapa and I can say, this is where I came from and I came to this land, this whenua of Māori. So I've made a home in someone else's country. And I think there is a thinking, like you ask, where can we go to? I think this ethnic identity within whiteness is really important in order to be able to stop just operating on power over others.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. And the reality is, my view is that, and I meet this on a regular basis out in the world, that those white people who are uncertain about their own whakapapa and identity are the most likely to grasp the power that comes from their whiteness. As I live out in West Auckland, surrounded by the descendants of Dalmatian tradesmen, right, in Glendina. And it's like a little part of Dalmatia. This is a community that for 100 years has been fiercely, ferociously proud of its Dalmatian origins. And because of that, they're very comfortable with all of the other cultures that come into the community. Living out west is a really interesting microcosm of what Aotearoa could be, because it is predominantly brown, because it's very low class and working class, but it's also a real melting pot of migrant communities who now live in little villages. Whereas what you get in the city and what you get out in the eastern suburbs and the shore is a more embourgeoise and, you know, wealthier community. They can leave their past behind because they're forging endlessly forward to some grand future. Whereas actually I live in a community where everybody's happy to celebrate our cultural origins. And that's what I wanted my kids to grow up in, is around communities of people who all really enjoy being different, but also like being part of a community. And I think it's how do we create spaces for that to happen? Because my sister, much older, you know, married and went to live in South Auckland. And the South is like the West. In fact, Auckland as a city is actually not a city. It's a bunch of little fiefdoms, of villages, kāinga, you know, and some people, I say this as somebody who teaches at a university where some of the years my students from South Auckland have never been to the city before and have come here because they're at university, because they live in communities where you just live in your village. Whilst that is good and strong, we also need to figure out how to be a nation. And that we're still wrestling with, but I again go back to the fact that I'm incredibly optimistic. We are less than 200 years old as a nation. Not many places can name the day they became what they are. We can. We have incredible ability to construct and to build. And I was thinking about this just today. You know, there's less people in this country than in Melbourne. And we're in a country that is 1,000 miles long, and yet we've managed to build roads and schools. I was saying this because I was stuck on the motorway at one of those on-ramps for an interminable amount of time. So, you know, I drifted off thinking about, gosh, isn't that a good motorway that we managed to build with a city with only 1 million people? I've lived in cities with 20 million people that don't have highways as good as we do. So we know how to do shit. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
So this is just another one of those things that we have to work out how to do. And I am incredibly optimistic because I work in a university and I'm surrounded by younger generations of people who I know do not think like that and who are the hope of the future. And what I say to them when they look perplexed at what is, you know, racial antipathy is, well, at least you're going to outlive them, my dear. Because a lot of those ideas are going to die out with us boomers. And the next generation, I think, who are global citizens, who live in a different world to the one I grew up in, are the hopefully the voice in the face of the future, who are, and then, you know, there's this wonderful young Maori comedian called Huane Hortene. He's very white. He's a ginger. And he makes a lot of jokes about the fact that, you know, white people get very upset about the fact that he's as white as he is, but he's Maori hard. And I just love the fact that he's lampooning this idea that people look at his face and think they understand his heart. And until we figure out how to understand each other's hearts better, I think we're just going to be caught up with the face at a time when the planet is facing a crisis. We are on the threshold of climatic crisis. Our species may not survive this century. So if we can't figure out how to work together more collaboratively, we are literally doomed. And on that chirpy note, I'm going to pass it back to you, Sally.
Thank you. Yeah, very positive.
I just wanted to add something to what Ella said. There were classroom experiments that were done by Ani Makaira at law school and by Kuni Jenkins and Alison Jones, where when the classroom was delivered by a Pacific peoples or Māori kaiako, the white students had difficulty with there not being the centre of attention and not being the centre of the kaupapa. And in some cases, one walked out because she felt that she wasn't being included. So I'm a little bit more sceptical about that things are going to die out with the boomers, because I think getting back to that lens, looking through a particular lens and the experience and being able to relate to why that young woman walked out, because when I have been on a marae at Kurereo, I sometimes have been one of two or three Pākehā, and that experience of not being the centre of the kaupapa is very humbling for a Pākehā. And if you are not in the right space to actually process and understand it with some form of educational awareness, then you can misinterpret your sense of, oh, I'm not the centre of attention. You know, I'm not the one that's being acknowledged here. But I was able to, on the marae, I would think, so this is how Māori feel when they're in a situation, a room full of white people, and historically. So that was one thing, just in response to something that you said. And the other thing I was thinking of is the attitude of Pākehā that when other people come here, they are immigrants rather than that they are new settlers. And for me, all people that come here are new settlers. They are part of our settler culture, which has now become multicultural. And so for me, I don't think of them as tau iwi. I think of them as settler, newer settler, older settler. I'm an older settler. I'm sixth generation. On my Irish Catholic side, I am a sixth generation white settler. I include all those cultures that have come here recently as settler cultures in someone else's country. So when I think of tangata tiriti, that's who I'm thinking of. I'm thinking of all the combined cultures that have come to whenua Māori.
It's lovely. Thank you. I don't think we can foist Maori culture on people. And I reminded of the, I think she was a prison officer who was told she had to go to a porphyry and then had to sit behind all the men and walked out because she felt outraged because she was bad. You know, and it wasn't until it was explained to her that a porphyry has different roles for men and women. They're not inferior. It starts with a woman's voice because the dead don't come for men. They come for us because they know we call in peace. And then the men stand up and talk and we sit behind and then we all sit together. I blame her employer for making this woman go on an experience without any background. And I guess that's the point you're making, Lizzie, is we all, those of us who understand the dynamics, have a responsibility to provide the background. Because once she understood that she wasn't being made, or she shouldn't have been, and that it was actually her employer who put her in a powerless position, she was much more open, you know. And that, I think, is what happens when non-Māori come into our world in a very safe way with the right guides. And it's lovely hearing you talking about Ani and Kuni because, they, you know, we all went to university together and I know the important work that they did paving the way for those coming later. But the reality is, we're still doing the work. We're still providing pathways. And I want to just get you to hold on to the word tauiwi, because tauiwi was used in the declaration. It's a word in whakaputanga that creators of the document used to describe people, iwi, from another shore. And they actually used tauiwi, the northerners, to describe South Islanders.
They wouldn't be wrong there, tauiwi.
That's a fight I'm not getting into, okay? But the word itself, it really literally means iwi, or people from another place, from another shore, from another land. And so I love that because we're all iwi. Mm. We're all bones.
Yeah.
You know, when you get right down to the word, iwi is nothing more, and you talked about whakapapa, is your bone connection to place. And you can be tau iwi, but you can also be tangata tiriti. And that's the joy of having these multiple capabilities. We can be whatever we define ourselves as a nation, as people. My saddest thinking around this is how Māori have inculcated some of the worst biases of white supremacy in our views of migrants. And you will hear Māori people saying terrible things about new migrants from Asia, from India, from the Pacific, because we've inculcated that, you know, it's kind of like we've become the sort of second-class white people being equally mean to the ones who came after. We're all part, I believe, personally, of a conscientization process. And if you know, and I just recently read a paper of criticizing Winston Peters for his continual use of the word woke without understanding it, because I am very happy and unashamedly wide awake. And I think anybody should be very happy to be wide awake, because that is conscientization. And if you are not woke, then you are a victim. And so people who are anti-woke just want to keep on oppressing you, quite frankly. And we've got to wake ourselves up because, as I said, the most important thing facing the planet at the moment is not racism. It's the environment. Our mother, the Earth, is bleeding and she's on fire.
Yeah, but, you know, I align people with that because for me, you know, I grew up like a little environmentalist, but then I realized there was pressing social issues. And I think if we don't deal with those social issues, we can't deal with the environment. Because you think of the wealth elite and they cause most of the pollution. You know, this thing about us recycling as individuals, it's nothing compared to the pollution that the big corporates do to the world. And the other thing, poor people, they can't worry about the environment when they're just worried about kai on the table and all the addiction things that are happening because of self-medication, you know, in the face of whatever pain they're trying to face. It was a favourite statement from a partner of mine in the past. He talked about self-medication. And so I always think of that. When I look at addictions and alcoholism and stuff, I look at it as self-medication for pain and for trauma. Yeah, so for me, fixing the environment is very much tied in for me with racism, with giving people a better life so that they actually have the time and the energy to actually join the struggle for climate reparation, for climate house.
I agree. I mean, we can't expect the people of Gaza or Sudan to fix the problems of the world. Oh. That is unfair. However, those of us who do have a teeny tiny little voice, I guess that's what I'm talking about, is encouraging our people to wake up, you know, maranga ake I e. You know, when I go into our communities and I see how broken some of them are, which fortunately are not the majority of the Māori population, but it's still a disturbingly high percentage. There's this sense of malaise of what can I do? What can I do? And I guess I could say, yes, you can't solve the problem, but I also want to say, but you can be part of the solution. We may not be able to solve the problems of the world, but we can move in the direction of those people who are creating policies and strategies. I read something really brilliant recently. Political parties are not lifetime relationships. They are public transport. You pick a bus that is going where you hope you want to go. And if it doesn't go there, you get off and find another one that will. It's not a permanent marriage. So we've got to find the political movements that are taking us where we want to go. And sometimes they don't, and we just, you know, get on another bus. Or we help the bus driver to fix the bus. I'm doing that at the moment. I'm trying to fix the bus so that next year when we go to the polls, we have a healthy, robust alternative to what we have now.
I don't know if you're aware, but I am a policy advisor and reporting person at Te Pūtahitanga o Te Waipounamu, which is the whanau ora organisation for the South Island that has been decommissioned by the government. So I've observed how when you help people to start up their own businesses, create jobs, and we're talking about Māori families, get kai on the table, get the children to school, the huge benefits of that, and then these people are going to Wānanga and they go for walks in the taiao, and then they start making connections with their mental health and their health, their connections with Te Ao Māori. For many of them, they haven't had it. They're estranged from whānau. This, when you were referring to that, you know, this connection, well, I've seen that happening, and you know, I'm editing reports that are coming in that talk about this happening for people who haven't had this before in their life. But this government that we've got hates Māori doing well, and we've been chopped. It's tragic. It's really appalling. And there'll be this great hole because the organisation, it will take it about probably 2 years to get up and running. So there's this hole, and it's really soul-destroying that commissioning and supporting whānau voice, whānau directed, and we were partners, whānau directed steps in their lives is not happening because the government only now wants to concentrate on bottom of the cliff navigators working with people in crisis. Now, we were doing that. We had navigators as well working with people in crisis, and that made amazing stories out of that. I just wanted to communicate, you know, this amazing generation of wellness that has been happening in the South Island through 11 years of Te Pūtahitanga o Te Waipounamu. And this was truly Tari Anaturia's vision. But her vision has now been pretty much
extinguished.
Yeah.
Let us be very clear, though. Every government in the world that has close ties with the Atlas Group.
Yes. Hate Indigenous, yeah.
Well, no, it's not even as clinical as that. I mean, Indigenous morality, Indigenous thinking is the impediment to mining.
An impediment to resources for them.
An impediment to sustainable resource management. Yeah. So those who have power, whether it is in the Amazonian rainforest, whether it is in the Arctic region, whether it is in the Australian outback, whether it is in Aotearoa, all of those places where the Atlas Network has been able to get some power, the assault on Indigenous people and Indigenous worldviews has been systematic and powerful. So the job of those of us who see this and know this, as I said, is to fix the bus so that there is a viable alternative. Because at the moment, I'm not sure there is a viable alternative for some people, and we have to fix the viable alternative to the current thinking. Because as I said right at the beginning, that in this book, The Truth About Us, The Politics of Information in India, the writer says what the British colonial rule were able to do was to change thinking about the caste system at a time when information was scarce and the colonizers' power over information was absolute. So who controls information, who controls media, controls thinking. And that is why programs like this, discussions like this, media like this are utterly critical to waking us up and being as woke as we possibly can be.
Yes. I love your definition of woke.
So as we're all just wrapping up, what are some things that we could or should be doing individually, independently, and how might we then, I guess, influence structural change or that higher level of change?
I think just doing what we're doing now. You know, everything starts with thought and word and for humans.
Activism, there has to be some degree of some kind. I mean, not all activisms are the same either. There's activism, I suppose, is just not being passive, meaning not being passive, not doing nothing. Yeah, doing something. Yeah.
And I love the term that they used last year for the hikoi, the variety of them that went on. They were not protests. They were not activisms. They were activations, because the exact opposite of passive is active.
Yes. Yes.
You know, the exact opposite of sleep is wake. So we're talking about how do we wake ourselves up? How do we conscientize ourselves? How do we use every opportunity we can and make it an activation?
I love that. Awake and activated.
Yeah, and it's not a conversation.
That's a ball.
It's a conversation. It's a reaching out a hand. It's a moment of shared communion. It's anything that really gets people to be with you for a moment and realize that the things that bind us are more important than the things that divide us.
Yeah, and the thing I want to add to that is that guilt. The white people don't go into guilt. What you've got to move into is, how do I make a difference with everyday things? How can I do things differently? Because guilt is just getting back to poor me. Oh, I'm feeling unhappy about the history of New Zealand. You know, it's useless, actually. Well, you need to know about the history, and you probably need to have a few tears about it, because it's pretty awful. But it's actually going from ignorance to knowledge. Yeah, that's an amazing transition, to actually not be ignorant anymore about New Zealand history, to not be ignorant about how it's still happening in New Zealand. Yeah.
Yeah, watch the documentaries, read the book, you know, wear the T-shirt, carry the slogan, whatever. I was in a cafe on the Hikoi in Wellington last year, and a Muslim woman in her hijab with her children had a little toy tutitity sign, and she stopped to give them a cup of tea. And as they were leaving, I just looked at her, because the only thing I know, I didn't even know if she was Arabic. I went, inshallah, and she went, kia ora.
Oh.
And it was a beautiful moment of potentiality.
Yeah.
And I hold on to those moments during the dark times.
Mm.
And I think that's so critical, isn't it? It is a pretty challenging time at the moment, I think, for a lot of people. We've talked about the environment. We've talked about racism. We've talked about white right wing. Yeah, it is. It's pretty dark at the moment, but those small moments are powerful.
Yeah.
And the best thing about it is we can produce those. You know, there's nothing like driving to work in peak hour to make you realize how potentially awful humans are. And also how potentially extraordinary. And I'm trying to, you know, just join one of the queues on the motorway, and 10 cars go by, and then this car just stops, and the smile happens, and you smile back, and you have a moment. And in amongst all the shitty behavior that we are capable of as human beings, those little moments make you realize how extraordinary we are as a species, and how we have potential to transform the world. And I have to hold on to that on the bad days.
Yeah.
Well, tēnā kōrua, thank you both so much. This has been such a vibrant, and I think you mentioned the word colorful, Lizzie, such a colorful and really uplifting and positive kōrero, actually. It's nice to have some moments. We've talked about the importance of these small moments, but I've come away feeling quite hopeful from this, which has been nice.
Awake and activated.
Yes.
Thank you, Alan.
Rock on, I say. Rock on. That's all we can do. I mean, I'm plummeting towards my dotage. I'm in my 70s now. The bulk of my life has gone. I'm sanguine about that. You know what I mean? It's okay. But I want to make sure that I use every breath I have to contribute to the good, because otherwise it's a wasted life and nobody wants a wasted life.
No.
Nō reira, ngā mihi nō nui ki a kōrua ki a koutou katoa, tēnā koutou, kia ora mai tātou katoa.
Kia ora.